Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to start today's show hearing about what's happening in the town of Georgia, including a little zip code controversy. We'll then open the phones one more time for the week until 10 o'clock. And national correspondent Bob Ney joins us, followed by Paula Ratley of 7 Days. She'll have some backstories on some of their pieces from 2021. And we'll finish this morning as cheddary as possible when we talk with the folks at Cabot about the many awards that they've garnered recently. But first, it's off to Georgia. We go to hear from St. Albans Messenger digital reporter Alec Flory. Alec, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. We're going to, listeners, we're going to talk to Alec all about Georgia, Vermont. If you want to ask him about any of his stories recently about Georgia, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Alec, tell us what's a bit odd about the COVID case numbers in Georgia, Vermont.
Yeah, sure. So my awareness of this, you know, started back in the summer where I wrote a story about why Georgia's case count was, since the beginning of the pandemic, since they started reporting COVID numbers by town in March of 2020, why Georgia's case rate has stayed at 22 cases. And just for, you know, some perspective, the surrounding towns, Milton, Fairfax, and St. Albans City, those numbers are 1,203 for Milton, 426 for Fairfax, and 1,659 for St. Albans City. So the numbers are obviously very low for Georgia. If we're thinking about a town like Norton, Vermont, which has a population of less than 200, the data says that they actually have 16 cases since the beginning of the pandemic. So obviously the data is skewed. And back then I did some reporting on the fact that Georgia is the way that cases are reported by town is by zip code. And Georgia actually has no zip code. They share a zip code with Fairfax, St. Albans, and Milton.
So you're not going to assume that the folks in Georgia have been so perfect in getting vaccinated and socially distancing, in protecting themselves, that there were 22 cases and then they just all behaved so perfectly.
That's exactly it.
All right.
The numbers are way too high in the surrounding towns.
So what is the connection between COVID case numbers and zip codes?
Well, the way that COVID cases are reported when people put down their addresses is by zip code. So Georgia has three different zip codes, 05454, 05468, and 05478, which are all of the surrounding towns. And even a place like St. Albans City is split up into St. Albans Town, Georgia, and Fairfax. So these numbers are not incredibly accurate when we're thinking about town borders.
Why doesn't Georgia have its own zip code?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure why they don't originally have a zip code, but the pandemic has kind of illuminated this issue that actually in Georgia has been happening for decades now, decades of confusion, basically. Back in the early 2000s, there was a move in Georgia to get them a zip code. There was actually a whole committee based around it. But for a number of reasons that I lay out in my article from a few days ago, that ultimately failed.
Well, it's very interesting. I don't want you to skip over that because it was put to a vote, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And so what were they able to choose? What was the result?
Yeah, so I spoke to Colin Conger, who is a longtime Georgia resident and was on this committee to try and get Georgia a zip code. And he is also a director for the Georgia Historical Society. His awareness of the zip code issue started when he was working for General Dynamics in Burlington, and he was also a part of an action committee dealing out United Way dollars to company employees. His interest began when he noticed that there were many mix-ups occurring because money that was supposed to be going to Franklin County was actually ending up in Chittenden County because many Georgia employees who lived in Georgia had Milton addresses. So he chaired this committee with Georgia residents like longtime Georgia resident Peter Millett, who was also on the Historical Society at the time. It's all with the goal of getting Georgia a zip code. He spoke to politicians to drum up interest, Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, basically anybody who would listen to him. At first they tried to get Georgia a post office, which didn't work. And then they pushed USPS to actually have a vote where Georgia residents could choose a zip code, out of one of the three that they already have. But the catch in that story is that the way that USPS had it was that whichever zip code they chose had to reach a 50% threshold. But when you have a town that's split up into three zip codes, none of those are able to reach that 50%. So it ended up failing and momentum completely stopped.
Everybody voting for their own zip code. And the vote being split three ways. I think the push to get a post office there came at a time when the U.S. Postal Service was actually getting rid of small town post offices. But again, Alec, okay, so, you know, people turned out, they voted. Why didn't one of two things happen? Why didn't the top vote getter become the zip code, or why didn't they have a runoff of the top two, like you would when you need 50%.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Colin Conger told me that USPS wouldn't agree to any further votes. They said that was it. I did speak to Steve Doherty, who is a spokesperson for USPS, and he said that towns can request their own zip code that would eventually go up to districts and headquarters for approval, but unless it improves mail flow, it probably won't happen.
Now, there have been, you mentioned, there have been 22 cases credited to Georgia of COVID.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? Because it doesn't have its own zip code, yet 22 did get credited to the town of Georgia.
Right. So that happens when cases are reported by town. The cases that showed up in Georgia, those 22, are because the state does contact tracing that eventually gets back to Georgia. But the problem is that only happens for around 50% to 60% of positive cases that the state receives.
Well, wouldn't all this be some kind of a badge of honor of perfect health for Georgia that they've been, you know, virtually COVID-free compared to the rest of the state?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, my journey to the story kind of came when I was watching a Milton Select Board meeting. And at the end, and they were discussing mask mandates, whether or not to bring a mask mandate to Milton. At the end of that conversation, Select Board Chair Darren Adams brought up the fact that the data is skewed because of the zip code issue. So when I went and spoke to Select Board Chair of Georgia, Scott St. Ange, he said it's actually difficult to justify these town-wide pandemic protocols when you don't really have any numbers to point to, especially in Georgia, where not only is their town case rate, you know, obviously odd, But also, it becomes even grayer when you think about the fact that their case rate is split between two counties. So it just gets grayer and grayer and grayer for a town like Georgia.
Yeah, it is hard to argue with that logic, because that is exactly what's happening. You know, another interesting kind of quirk of all this is when the town of Georgia sends out town meeting day notices, it gets a little confusing, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so when I also spoke to him, it just makes a multitude of things harder.
Yeah.
I spoke to Amber Baker, the town manager, and originally I went into that conversation with the idea that we were going to speak about the pandemic mostly. But she was like, you know, the problem is so much bigger than the pandemic and actually makes a lot of things, ways that the town operates, more difficult. If Georgia had their own zip code, they could just, you know, write that zip code down for all the town meeting day notices, and then it would just get sent to all addresses within that zip code. Since it's split between three, it just adds even more confusion. Amber Baker, the town manager, actually told me that for newer Georgia residents, it's pretty hard for them to even know where to vote when you have a St. Albans phone number, a Milton address, things like that. So you can imagine the amount of confusion that would occur.
Yeah. Now, okay, this story really had me worked up, Alec. Well done on the way you wrote it and the research you did. And I don't live in Georgia, right? So have you heard from the people of the town about, you know, any move now, how to fix the situation? Are they, you know, kind of worked up about it like I am?
It's such a good question. Unfortunately, I have not. From my conversation with Colin Conger, you know, he worked. It's so obvious how passionate he was about this back then.
Yeah.
That to this day, he still puts Georgia, Vermont, and the zip code as if the vote had passed. Right now, I think that interest is really low, but who's to say? Maybe it'll increase because of this article.
Touche, Colin Conger. All right. Alec, did you ever think a zip code story could have so many intricate moving parts?
No, I you know, this was something that I had known about, but until that Milton Select Board meeting that we talked about earlier, it kind of got bigger and bigger as I made more calls. And it also is especially interesting when you think about, you know, a ranking of these, the towns by case rate. So we're thinking about, you know, when you're looking at that list, you see St. Albans City at the top of that list. But really, that's not really true that, you know, there's more cases in St. Albans City than anywhere else, because St. Albans City itself has, you know, three towns with three zip codes around it. So, no, I mean, the issue, it grew as I, and especially since it's had such a long history.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that I've been hearing from Georgia residents for a long time, but I was happy that I was able to put it on paper.
Well, yeah, thanks for pulling that string. And one point you made in the story, Georgia has like the 35th highest population in the state, but according to the case count numbers, it's way, way down the list in Vermont. Now,
yeah, and I actually don't know if that number, if the 35th number is still true with the new census data.
Oh, right.
I was quoting Colin Conger from back then. I would have to double check that.
Okay.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, they have a population of 5,000, which is just as much as St. Albans City and St. Albans Town.
Wow. Now, we really need to get Georgia sorted out. Let's talk next about policing, the policing situation there. For a while, there was no police presence in Georgia. What happened?
Yeah, so there was a big hole in policing services. And when I say policing services, I think that people usually think, oh, you know, 911 calls. Mm-hmm. But when I say policing services, it really is patrolling. So police been driving around the town, you know, clocking people for speeding, things like that. They had a contract with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office that the sheriff breached 10 months early. And the town said they were given basically virtually no notice about the move from the sheriff's office. Sheriff's office said that he could not financially endure, his department couldn't financially endure the last 10 months of the contract. So they broke it. When I started reporting on that story, I don't think a lot of people understand how a sheriff's office works, where you have a policing service that is contracted by towns, where they sign a contract and they pay for their services. The contract in Georgia that was signed by a previous sheriff and a previous select board was apparently not enough for the increases in spending that the sheriff, that the new sheriff was doing in his tenure.
And how many hours a week of patrolling was Georgia getting from the Franklin County Sheriff's Department?
Georgia was getting, let me check, I think it was over 40 hours. So it was quite a bit. And what ended up happening was there's this huge hole in policing services in Georgia where they didn't have anything. They were, you know, looking for other avenues. They ended up signing a memorandum of understanding with the Milton Police Department for a significantly lower amount of hours. I think it's 8 hours per week. Right. So, you know, going from 40 hours a week to 8 hours a week, that's a big difference.
That is a massive difference. It's merely 25%. You know, they're just down, they're down to eight. What does Georgia think about the protection that they're receiving now from the Milton Police Office that is 8 hours a week?
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting is that what I'm hearing from Georgia officials is that they're actually having a better relationship with Milton Police. And they're actually seeing Milton police cars out more. It seems like a kind of paradox, but yeah. The way that Milton operates now is they will go to the Georgia town offices and ask, you know, where do you want us to be today? Where is it going to be busy today? And they'll go out there and cover that area. So, and that's coming from town manager Amber Baker. I do want to say about those previous negotiations with the Franklin County Sheriff's Department, they entered into multiple, I think twice, tried to renegotiate this contract. But since the town had already budgeted for the money, they couldn't find any extra money to give the sheriff if they wanted to. So that ended up failing, and then sheriff pulled out.
Wow. Well, kudos to the Milton Police Department for the work they're doing in Georgia now. Now, another story you've been covering is on a communications union district in your area. Tell us about Northwest Fiberworks.
Yeah, so Northwest Fiberworks, it used to be the Northwest Communications Union District, which is kind of a mouthful, so they changed it
yes,
to Northwest Fiberworks. I began reporting on that when they were still a volunteer organization. Sean Kayo, the director, he was, you know, doing all volunteer hours, and they've grown very quickly, signing other municipalities on, and they actually just signed their first municipality in Chittenden County with Milton. Mm. So they're quickly growing, and now Sean Kayo actually does this full time. It's a paid position. They're receiving grants from the state and working on hiring staff.
Is Georgia included in the Northwest Fiberworks?
Georgia is included in Northwest Fiberworks.
Yes. All right. And let's tell people the Communications Union District. Just remind, what is the goal of the CUD, Northwest Fiberworks?
Yeah, so the goal of the CUD is to bring broadband access to everywhere in Vermont. That's the goal of the CUD in general. You know, Franklin County historically has incredibly bad service, mm-hmm. and I think broadband access and service in general. I think that the pandemic has kind of illuminated this issue across the state. But yeah, Northwest Fiberworks in Franklin County just wants to bring broadband access everywhere, meaning better download speeds, better internet access.
How many municipalities are involved right now with Northwest Fiberworks?
Oh, there are a lot. I don't know the exact number, but I want to say it's upwards of 10. I would have to get back to you on that.
All right. I thought it was closer to 20.
That might be it.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
All right. Is there funding in place? Are they still working on that? You mentioned grants.
Yeah, there's tons of funding in place. There's so much money coming from the state for these CUDs. I reported way back in November that they got a few grants to hire positions, and I would bet they've definitely gotten more money since then from my talks with Sean Kyle.
Yeah, yeah. There's ARPA funds. There's the infrastructure funds on the way, too, that the legislature will be divvying up during this session. So that looks good for Northwest Fiberworks and other CUDs. And do you have a timeline on when they'll start rolling out fiber and when they might get it to just about all of Franklin County?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I know that Sean Kyle wants to begin construction in Franklin and Grand Isle counties by 2022, but he said he probably most likely won't get a full construction season in. This is definitely a long process.
Gotcha. Alec Flory is the digital reporter for the St. Albans Messenger. He should be made mayor of Georgia. You can find his stories at sammessenger.com. Alec, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Rick.
All right, take care. Great to hear, get a good wrap-up of a town like Georgia. Thanks so much, Alec. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back for some open phones. And today at 4 o'clock on WDEV, it's the afternoon news service. That's followed by the Brady Farkas Show. Then he turns things over to Craig Durham for the call of Norwich Hockey for their match against the Hobart College Statesmen. That starts at 6:35. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, we've got some time to hear your thoughts until 10 o'clock. The phones are open at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I have several emails left over regarding the January 6th attack on the Capitol, so I'll get to those. I also want to share the obituary of Curtis Whiteway of Craftsbury, who passed away last week. I mentioned that earlier in the week and haven't gotten to it, so I hope to read that for you today. But I am interested to hear your thoughts, maybe share what you hope for 2022 for yourself, for Vermont, the country, the world. Doesn't have to be a personal resolution, but more your wish for all of us. If you'd like to jump in with your thoughts, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And let's see. Here's Betsy. This is really interesting. Betsy in Starksboro. I really enjoyed reading this. She said, in regards to the caller who warned you against becoming too political, that was Lee in Barrytown yesterday. Betsy writes, I just wanted to say that you did a fantastic job of presenting the subject matter in an appropriate way. Defending democracy should not be viewed as partisan. We must always be willing to speak up against efforts to subvert it, and I was glad to hear you speak with truth and honesty. I wasn't able to call in, but what kept coming to mind that I would have loved to have shared was in regards to the Bush versus Gore election in 2000. That was the first presidential election in which I voted, and I think it bears mentioning that there was a large percentage of voters who weren't pleased with the outcome following the controversy surrounding the infamous hanging chads and the halting of the recount in Florida. Yet we did not see violence at our nation's capital. Those who voted for Al Gore accepted the result, and though they may not have done so happily, there was overall acceptance followed by a peaceful transfer of power. Betsy, I'm embarrassed because I lived in Florida in 2000 during that election. I should have been able to, should have recalled that and brought that up. That is an excellent example of where there was controversy, where there was anger about the outcome and about the Supreme Court stepping in and saying we're stopping the count and awarding the presidency to George W. Bush. And there was no attack on the Supreme Court or on the White House or on Congress. So, Betsy, thank you for passing that along. That really does it does make sense. It is an excellent example, a very similar situation of what happened. Let's go to Fred, the Duke of Newbury first. Hi, Fred. What do you got for me today?
Let's see here. I'm fascinated with history. I think it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they say about history. If you don't read history, you condemn yourself to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the question. Will the Biden-Trump era be a major chapter in American history, or will it just be a footnote?
I'm going to accept that as a rhetorical question today and really mull that over. It's hard to say that any presidency is just a footnote, but it could be. I get your point. There might not be anything really significant, shaping where we go as a country or otherwise. Fred, a good point today. All right. Elvin from Addison County. How you doing, Elvin?
Okay. Look at what I'm trying to bring out here, and I hope you can catch the flow here.
Okay.
But come February, around February, I understand that all these little flip phones that people have, especially people that are elderly and that are on very low incomes, and it's the only method of communications they have, that they can afford. It's a simple little thing. It's not your higher class phone.
Right.
And come February, they're phasing that I think it's there's a group 5 or
four 5G 5G
yeah the G5s are 4
right.
They're phasing that thing out, and what a shame for people, because there's a lot of people that can't afford the newer phones, and a lot of the elderly people can't even learn how to use them, and so I was just hoping that maybe people listening will look into this too, and call their necessary people to see why they're doing this. And it's something that's of great aid, especially if elderly people are out and traveling, and it's their only way of communicating if something happens. And I just can't believe that they're doing that. It's a simple little phone. It's worked, and I don't know why they don't keep it going.
I'm going to claim stupidity on this. I did not know that was happening. It reminds me, Elvin.
I hope you can look into this.
Yeah.
For the sake of those people that are going to need phone service. And, they're going into all this money going into broadband stuff and everything.
Right.
And here the people that need that broadband are up there where they have to travel long distances, and they don't have if they don't have a little phone with a little cell service there, they're in tough shape.
Elvin, it kind of reminds me of the change we saw in television broadcasting several years back. I don't know if you remember this, but I remember going in and getting a new TV, and I was told this was a number of years ago, but you're going to need, in 3 years, you're going to have an HD TV. So yeah. You want to buy one now. And, you know, people who had non-HD TVs were kind of left in the lurch. I think they were able to hold on to them for a little while. I did not know about, you know, the flip phones, and I'll look into this.
Yeah, well,
that's,
you know,
very interesting.
Rick, my name is Belden, B-E-L-D-E-N.
Oh, Belden, Rick, okay.
You know, the thing is, TVs, you know, everybody's can got one or not necessary, but a little phone is certainly a necessary thing for a lot of people.
Yep.
And the FCC should be, you know, the government should be looking, the federal government should be looking into this.
Yep.
To make sure that this doesn't happen, or because, you know, all these people, they just don't have any other way. And they should be able to have access to a phone system. So I'm going to leave it there, Rick.
Okay.
I really appreciate your help there.
I appreciate you calling.
Say again, please?
I said I appreciate you calling. This is.
Well, thank you, Rick. And you're doing a great job there, okay?
All right, you take care. Thanks, Belden. Wow. Anybody else know anything about that? Please feel free to call in. That's something we'll need to look into. All right. Let me read another email. This is what Pam emailed me January 6th. I remember watching in shock as it all unfolded, and my shock continued and still continues as many Republicans continue to try to rewrite history, and it still makes the bile rise. Happy New Year. Despite the coming 2022 election. So, Pam, not excited about it being an election year. Thank you for that. I also heard from Roma. And, again, I appreciate emails like this one that I received from Roma. And she takes me to task, and she well should. I have no problem with that. Here's what Roma said. I listened to you mislead your listeners the other day when you insisted that the events of January 6th, 2021 was not about political party. I don't know if you're intentional or not, and that really isn't pertinent. There is only one major political party in the United States that spent the summer and fall of 2020 building up a totally made-up voter fraud hysteria. That same political party spent resources of many types to help investigate and organize the demonstration that became the riot insurrection. Only one political party in our country spent 2019 and 2020 pushing violence and guns as a proper means to political ends. Only one political party wants to ignore not only January 6, 2021 itself, but all the events that led up to that date and the decades of events that empowered the violent Limbaugh, Palin, Trump philosophy, and made that the central theme of the Republican Party. None of this is a secret. All of it is ignored when folks such as yourself try to both sides life. It just ain't so. Roma, thank you for your opinion and that email. Well crafted, I appreciate that. I'd love to hear how you'd like to see the world change for the better in 2022. What can we all do to understand one another and accept all others' opinions? You can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before the break, we heard from Belden in Addison County, worried about flip phones not being able to be used after February. It's actually, we had someone call in to point out, it is 3G that's being phased out, so that would impact flip phones. And I found a story. It says phasing out 3G will also impact older home security systems, tablets, smartwatches, some medical devices. That's according to the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. So if anyone does know more about phasing out of 3G and how that will impact people who've been holding on to flip phones, love to hear from you. Let's go next to Jim in Barrie. Hi, Jim. What's going on?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I called the other day and was talking to the folks from Generator. And it kind of got cut short. I was talking about patents and makerspaces.
Yep.
There's a very specific reason that makerspaces should be doing what they call non-disclosure agreements as part of their membership. But the answer that they gave me kind of annoyed me, because I've heard it before. It's kind of a political answer. There seems to be some sort of a movement that's an anti-patent movement right now in the country. It came out of the open source software movement in California.
Oh, right.
Open innovation, they call it, and so forth. But what happens in a patent application is that you can't file for a patent after 1 year, further out from a year from when it was publicly disclosed. And when you do use it when you make it in a makerspace, mm-hmm. there's an argument out there that says that that is a public disclosure. And the way to close that loop is that everyone that joins the organization has part of their application that they don't disclose. So it's just like you showed it to a company or whatever, they agreed not to disclose it.
Right.
Whether anyone discloses it or doesn't disclose it becomes irrelevant to the but only to the point that if someone's applying for a patent and someone else challenges it, they may use that as saying it was already disclosed, it was a public disclosure, they're not eligible for a patent, unless you can show those disclosures. So that's a critical part of it.
Yeah.
But what's political about it is that they always tout, we have a rapid prototype system. Why would someone want to get a rapid prototype but not be concerned about a patent? Those two go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So it, there's sort of a political push there against the patent. And they're kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth.
Well, Jim, I want to apologize. So when you first called in the other day, it was very difficult to hear you. And then you called back with very limited time, and we had to really move. And I apologize.
I was going to apologize to you for the feedback on it, because I was under the impression that my Bluetooth was on, so I was talking through the speaker, through the radio in my car.
Yeah.
When in fact the Bluetooth wasn't on, and all I was doing was having my phone be 2 feet away from my radio in my car, and it was also complicated by the fact I kept getting a bad signal in downtown Montpelier. I had to keep changing channels. But
yeah.
But
so
anyway,
let me just tell you what I heard
that I wanted to make.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I don't know enough about this, and I'm not going to speak for Generator or any makerspaces. You saw it as, an anti-patent movement. I almost saw it as, something that a lot of places, a lot of people have to worry about, and that's liability. And they were almost like, covering themselves against liability if someone did do what you said. They just want to cover themselves kind of blanketly for something like that happened. But I'm not speaking for them. That's just how I kind of interpret it.
Mostly, if someone signs as part of their application a non-disclosure agreement, and we've talked about this in the Foundry as well, some were in favor of it, some were against it.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily change the operation. I collaborated with people all day long over there. But if it's in the application that they agree not to disclose stuff outside, there's no onus or responsibility or burden put on the organization to enforce that. So it's almost impossible to prove that they did disclose it. But if it's not in the application, then someone else might say that was a public disclosure, they're now ineligible for a patent. And that's it's true with the provisional patent, and it's true with the non-provisional patents as well. So anyway, that was the point that I was trying to make, and I it was kind of interesting that she started stuttering when I was talking about it, because they just don't like the idea of patents, because they want it to be in fact, that was the answer I got from the guy at UVM. He immediately started saying, well, that's the antithesis of what we're trying to do. We're trying to collaborate, and we're trying to be creative and whatever.
Yeah.
Then don't talk about rapid prototyping, because prototyping is the term used for something that's going to go to market later on.
Gotcha.
So,
Jim,
anyway,
thank
that's
you.
That's my point. You have a great day.
All right, you too. Thanks for calling back and explaining that further while we had more time. I do appreciate that. I do want to take the last few minutes to read the obituary of a gentleman who lived in Craftsbury. His name is Curtis Whiteway. He was born November 3rd, 1925, and died last Monday, December 27th, 2021. And I'll just read as much as I can of the obituary that ran about him. It says it is with the deepest sorrow that we announce the passing of our beloved husband, father, and grandfather, Curtis Roy Whiteway, 96 years old. He was born November 3rd, 1925. He and his family lived in Franklin Park, Boston. A week before he passed, he woke up briefly to tell a visiting friend, quote, "I dreamt I was a cowboy fighting my last battle with the bad guys." He had watched his favorite TV series, Gunsmoke, earlier that day. His friend added that we know what battle that really was. He shall be remembered riding up in the stars on the wings of a great white horse covered in purple hearts. Curtis Whiteway was an Army staff sergeant from 1943 to 1946, and he was in Army intelligence from 1948 to 1949. He enlisted in the Army in 1943 at 18 years old and received specialized training as an Army Ranger. He was assigned to the 99th Infantry Division, 394th Regiment, 2nd Battalion, Company E, nicknamed the Checkerboards, which referred to its checkerboard shoulder patch. Curtis and the Checkerboards, what a great name for a band. Curtis and the Checkerboards did their share in liberating the concentration camps during World War II. He received the following military awards in recognition of his contributions to public service and the fight against prejudice and hatred. He got the Silver Star. He got 3 Bronze Stars and 3 Purple Hearts. In 1970, Curtis and his family moved to Plainfield, Vermont. The following is a summary of a story Tim Clark wrote in November of 1986 titled The Righteous Gentile in Yankee Magazine. Art Edelstein of the Montpelier Times-Argus reported that Whiteway was being honored as a liberator and righteous Gentile in Israel during the Yom HaShoah, a day set aside to remember the Holocaust. During the ceremony, 800 participants rose to their feet. This brings me to tears. To give Whiteway a standing ovation in appreciation of a most unique person and friend. That trip to Israel on May 5th, 1986, changed his life and led him on a journey of discovery, drawing from the moral sense that he learned from his early life. Thank you, Curtis Whiteway. Okay, let's shut the phones down for this week. I want to thank everyone who shared their thoughts this morning and this week and yesterday as we reflected on January 6, 2021. We've got the top of the hour, CBS News up next. Then we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world and the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock, it's Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Dr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us now. We're going to get an update on what's happening in the rest of the country, around the world. Bob, it's been 2.5 weeks. I miss you, Bob. How you been?
I'm okay. I went through 2 COVID tests, so I have been through the home COVID test process. Kind of interesting.
Oh, my. And you're okay.
Both came back negative, but it's a very interesting process on your laptop, and you have a voice that comes over and you move your camera down so they can see the test kit. It was interesting to go through.
Wow. That is interesting. I haven't done that. Well, let's start with the COVID numbers, Bob.
Right. Of course, our death toll has went to where we never thought it would, but 833,560 people in the United States. And then worldwide, 5,471,000 deaths. Now, the new Omicron cases have more than tripled in the past 2 weeks since we've talked, which shatters all the records across the United States since we've been keeping them on the COVID issue. And the Omicron variant, though, appears to be at least a lot milder than they thought it would be. And so the hospitalization rate luckily, even though we've got an explosion of 225% increase on new cases per day, the hospitalization rate was a seven-day average. This is up to December the 14th, was 7,814 people. That was a 4% increase, but with the large 225% increase, thank goodness, the hospitalization rate didn't match that with 225% increase. Wow. And then the current seven-day moving average of new deaths did increase to 8.2%. And since we have talked last, the vaccinations are up a bit, I'm going to say. 61.2% of the total U.S. population have been fully vaccinated. So it's creeped up. I think you and I talked, it was probably 59% or 60%.
Right. It's just inching along.
Slowly.
Yeah. I'll give you a little, snapshot of what's happening here in Vermont. I mean, in 2020, if we had double figures of cases in a day, we were a little shaken. We had a day over 2,000 here in Vermont in one day. Now, granted, Omicron and a lot of testing right now, but it is a scary proposition. I think one thing, that should be pointed out, you've mentioned, Bob, that the effects aren't as severe as like Delta variant. But it should be noted that, it still can be severe, especially if you are unvaccinated.
Yeah, that's correct. It shouldn't be taken lightly. And of course, I've had this debate, including family members of mine who have said, you see, why did you get vaccinated? You could still get this, although I didn't. But as I told them, it gives us a better chance if we're vaccinated, and the cases, you're right, and I was remiss in pointing that out, the cases where people are getting hospitalized due to Omicron tend to be people who have not been vaccinated. So the vaccinations lessen, I guess, in most cases, not everybody, but lessen the effect.
All right. Let's segue right to the Supreme Court, where, they're testing. It's the vaccine and testing rules that President Biden has put in place. What are we hearing there? What are they considering?
Well, they're actually going to do arguments today. They're going to start the hearing process of arguments, whether to allow the Biden administration to enforce the vaccine testing requirements. And, of course, this is in the area of large employers. And then there was a separate vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. The argument's going to take probably a couple of hours today. Who knows what the Supreme Court will do, but they are taking up the cases, which should at least help to clarify where we're at on them, because some of the states have said you don't have to do this, and the federal government has said you have to do it. People are kind of stuck all over the place, not just the employees, but obviously the employers. Yeah. So this will bring some clarity when the Supreme Court decides. Supreme Court could turn around and decide it based on who said to do it. For example, if the White House, through executive order, gave the authority for the Center for Disease Control to do it, Supreme Court could come back and say, well, it's an act of Congress that needs to occur, or a direct executive order. I mean, who knows how they'll rule.
Sure.
So they could maybe not rule that you don't have to get a vaccine, but they might rule that the process of how it came about didn't meet constitutional muster. So we'll have to see what they decide.
All right. All eyes on the Supreme Court for that. Yesterday, President Biden, on the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol, made a speech. And what were your thoughts about what the president said yesterday?
I've got two paths on this one, I guess, Rick. One is he could have just, commemorated the day, the disaster that occurred, the people that were affected, and not went in whatsoever to, former President Trump, period. He could have done that. And that might have been more particularly, I guess, statesman-like. But he chose to bring in, a mixture of what happened and the former president without saying his name. And I must say, I think the way he did it was extremely brilliant, actually. They didn't say Trump's name. he said, "What did you see?" And then he asks a couple of times in his speech, "And what did you, what you didn't see?" And so whoever crafted that together for him did it in the style that it wasn't just a sort of a hateful, you know, tirade against Trump as much as he's relating, you know, this is your building, this is what happened, this is what he did. I thought it was very interesting how he did it. I thought it was the delivery of the speech I thought was excellent. I mean, as far as speeches go, I think it was one of the best I've ever seen Joe Biden give as what either a senator or as president.
Yeah.
But again, he could have taken the other path. But there are a lot of people that have urged him to take the gloves off. This is kind of his first take the gloves off, to be frank about it.
Yeah, and some of my callers yesterday did criticize him for that, for reaching back and talking so much about the election and when, you know, the important thing was the attack itself was wrong. Let's focus more on that. The former President Trump was going to speak yesterday about, again, the 2020 election. He deferred, and I think he'll wait till he gets to Arizona. Sometimes it just seems kind of tone deaf when he says, "Oh, I'm going to talk on January 6th," when really it's time to just hide away for a little bit, step aside, and let this country heal a bit from what has occurred.
Right. I would categorize this one as advisors one, Trump zero. The advisors won on this. I promise you, his inner circle of advisors, when he announced he was going to do a January 6th press conference, went to him and said, "Please, please don't do this."
Yeah.
It was a very smart move for him to cancel. And like I said, I was divided on a two-path. One, Biden did give a good speech, and the way he went after Trump was very politically well done. Mm-hmm. But he could have just kept it straight to, you know, what happened to the staff, the officers, you know, the terrible thing that happened to the country.
Yeah.
And then at some point in time, on another day, you know, went into Trump and what he thought of that. So
when you're president,
I think Trump canceling was good.
When you're president and I'm your vice president, that's how we're going to handle things.
Where does this country go?
Hey, speaking of former vice presidents, Dick Cheney was there yesterday, wasn't he, in Washington?
Right. Did you ever think you would see the day when Republicans are calling him a liberal? Think about that.
Never in my wildest dreams. So explain why he was labeled a liberal.
Well, he's a former member, and if you're a former member, you have floor privileges for life, and they pointed that out in the article. So you can go on the floor when you want, and that's what he did. As a former member of the House, he went on the floor with his daughter to commemorate the day. I thought the vice president's comments were pretty on target, that he felt this was a serious thing that happened. You know, he didn't get into the whole, you know, Trump issue, but he felt it was a serious thing that happened. And he also, of course, had mentioned he was, you know, proud of his daughter for standing up for what she believed. But he said more Republicans should, you know, look at the day for what it was. Obviously he got some headlines, you know, for going there.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was with his daughter. And again, he has the right as a former member to go onto the floor.
Yeah. One more quick thing. January 6th committee and the Senate, you think they're on a potential collision course. Explain why.
Well, the January 6th committee is on a collision course with itself, number one.
I'd have to agree with this.
This is a year later. What took them so long? They're talking about prime time in March and April. We can do another show on that if you like. But as far as the election, here's another case example. The committee is saying, well, you know, we don't want to necessarily follow the Senate's election reform path, and if they do this, they're going to dilute other election reform bills. This is like a deja vu, where when the progressives came out and said, you know, we don't want an infrastructure bill unless we have the Build Back Better America bill, and then they fought the infrastructure bill. Well, the infrastructure bill is the only thing that won this year, and it should have just been a win, and it was, you know, really kind of skimmed over. And now what they're saying is we don't want to redo the electoral process of how, you know, they call the vote and what they do to clarify all of this for the future. Because if they do that, they said if the Senate does that, which is heading towards a bipartisan effort, by the way, to do it, then we can't win on voting reform. Well, you kind of should tackle, you know, issues separately. So
yeah.
I don't think they're going to behoove themselves any great benefits as a select committee controlled by the Democrats to fight the Democratic Senate.
Yeah. National correspondent Bob Ney, always great hearing from you, getting your perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
This week is one of those special issues put out by 7 Days, although my next guest would argue that they're all special. And that's hard to argue. The start of the new year is an opportunity for readers to get the backstory on some of the pieces that they read throughout 2021. Joining me now to share some of them is 7 Days publisher Paula Routley. Paula, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great having you.
I got a little cold.
That's all right. Don't worry about that. Okay. Now, let's start with a story that is particularly appropriate because it occurred exactly a year ago today. Derek Brower was out chasing around a story at 2 a.m. in the extreme Vermont cold. Tell us about that.
Okay. I just want to say, generally speaking, journalists are instructed to keep themselves out of the drama they document. but it's impossible not to be moved by the stories that Vermonters share with us. And yeah. At the end of the year, we ask our reporters to recall everything they wrote in the last 12 months with an eye to the stories behind the stories. Things that happened to them in the course of reporting that didn't make it into the final piece. In the case of Derek's story, this didn't make it into the story that he wrote, but he knew that there was a busload of Vermonters going down to Washington, for this event, and that the bus was coming back at some point to this parking lot in South Burlington where it left. And he got there, I think, at 2. It was freezing cold. He's in his car. He doesn't know if he's missed it or if it's coming. Just the anxiety and anticipation. He describes really well the anxiety and anticipation of waiting for that bus and almost bailing and then deciding, I think he saw like a Channel 5 car across the parking lot and decided to wait a little longer. Sure enough, the bus arrives, they got out and he got some great quotes from the people on board. Just the patience and discomfort that's often involved in getting these stories. I thought he just did a really good job of recalling that.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's still timely, that story. So.
Yeah, these backstories do peel back that curtain of journalism that you don't read in stories, but tell you kind of the story behind the story. I'd really like to know when Courtney Lambden is headed for vacation. What happens when she goes away, Paula?
Actually, she broke the Max Tracy story last night.
Oh, well done.
And what I liked about her anecdote was it shows what it's like to cover a beat that's as demanding as Burlington. A lot of our reporters are sort of loose beats that they cover, but Courtney's, there's nothing loose about Courtney's. So she's up until, 2 a.m. Every night there's a city council meeting. She stays up and writes an online story about it. And so there's a lot of pressure on her not to miss anything. And she's expected to find stories that no one knows about, but also has to report news that is announced and reported. So it's a lot to cover, and she does a great job. And I liked how she, came up with these three examples. She's working on something today. You'll want to check out, too.
All right, good. It's good that Courtney is not on vacation and news is breaking.
Yeah.
Good for Courtney. She does not avoid. She does not avoid breaking stories. Breaking stories seem to avoid her. Now, Paula, I've had Kevin McCallum on this show several times, and he does a great job when he's on, but I am now going to be extra nice to him. Please tell us about the backstory called Best Blowback, and please mind your language.
Nastiest blowback.
Yeah, nastiest.
Yeah, not.
Yeah, nastiest. Part. That's right.
Yeah, so we heard about a new state-of-the-art indoor firing range in Waterbury.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked Kevin to check it out. And, of course, that would include firing a weapon. He was reluctant, and now I think I know why. So, you know, he tried out some guns, and his description of firing a high-powered rifle did not sit well with the gun-loving crowd. They didn't think it was accurate. So we got a ton of hate mail, most of which I published in the form of letters to the editor, but there was no note in this package that arrived, this mysterious package that arrived, addressed to Kevin, and that he wrote about here. I don't think I'll reveal what was inside, maybe just to entice people to check out the story and find out. But
you're so good at this.
When you get a package like that, you open it at arm's length, you know? Mm-hmm. And what was inside surprised us. You can tell your listeners if you want, but it was insulting and misogynist, and I know he'll never forget.
It. All right, let's move on to one that was deemed most intriguing drive-by, and this is one you were involved with.
Oh yeah. So as I said, I don't get out much because I'm the publisher, and but every once in a while they throw me a story just to keep me, keep my writing muscles in shape. Mm-hmm. And I was just doing a piece on what to do around Lake Willoughby for our Stay Tripper supplement. But on the way to Willoughby, we passed a horse and buggy with an Amish family in it. And I knew that the Amish were settling here. And we've tried to get, it's a very difficult story to get because they don't want to talk. And, you know, you want to be sensitive to their culture. And, the men only talk to men, the women only talk to women. It's complicated, but you know, little signs of them kept coming up throughout the whole trip. You know, their preserves, different people were interacting with them around Willoughby. And so I made a note, as I always do, like I found like six stories I wanted to do in the course of doing this one. And that was one of them. There was a public dinner, a benefit dinner for them, for this family whose child needed medical attention. And so it seemed like it might be an opening for a reporter in the summer. And anyway, BPRB is to it. So it's meant to illustrate just, you know, how you look for stories. How sometimes we miss them, or somebody, you know, we're competitive with other media outlets, and they beat us to this one, unfortunately. They did a Brave Little State about it, which was, and the reporter had some relevant experience, so that was also a first-person piece, but I still want to write about the Amish somehow.
Yeah. Now, I loved Chris Farnsworth's story on Memorial Auditorium. He actually shared that on this show when it came out. Yeah. But tell us the backstory. This one was called Best Memory Maker.
Yeah, so this is Chris's first cover story.
Yeah.
He's really great, and he's our music editor. We've written about Memorial a lot over the years, but there was a special election in December with a ballot item that might have sealed the fate of the building. So we decided to do it again. But this time we really focused on the history, and everybody has a memorial story. So Chris, he's such a good writer. He described this encounter on Church Street he had after the story came out. So someone berating him for not including a Primus show that, he was of particular importance to this individual. So Chris tried to explain to him, you know, we couldn't include everything. But it did, that particular story, we're still getting letters about it, saying you didn't mention this concert, you didn't mention this fight, you know. So it was a rich vein, as it turned out. I thought Chris did a really good job. But he learned, you know, that I actually made the same point in mind, that the story is never complete. There's always more to say. So.
Yeah. Do you remember your favorite show at Memorial Auditorium?
I think I had a ticket to Bob Marley but he never played. I mean, he did play there once, but he was scheduled to play again, and he didn't make it. I think he might have died. So I kept the ticket forever. That doesn't answer your question. I'm trying to remember.
Well, still, that's an interesting, that is an interesting backstory of the backstory. I like that. I appreciate that answer. Well done, Paula. Listeners, you can read all of the backstories in this week's issue of 7 Days and at 7daysvt.com. Paula Routley, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for news, and then we'll be back to hear about Cabot's Hall of Cheese Awards. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and let's talk cheese. I've mentioned this before. It's getting close to 19 years now. No, that's not the amount of time I've been aging a prized cheddar, rather the amount of time I've lived in Vermont and the amount of time there has been at least one Cabot product in my fridge. Cheddar, butter, sour cream, yogurt, they're the staples. Now there are boxes of the mac and cheese in the cupboard as well. Well, proving that I have impeccable taste, the National Milk Producers Federation just bestowed oodles of awards on the cheeses of Agrimark's cheese production facilities. And we're going to talk about championship cheeses with Gina Accorsi. She is Cabot Creamery cheese grater. And let me be clear before you think that Gina shreds all that Cabot cheese. That's grater with a D, not greater with a T. Gina, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much for having me today, Rick.
You're welcome. We also have Jason Martin. He's Agrimark's Vice President of Manufacturing. Jason, great to have you on the show as well.
Good morning, Rick, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got questions for our guests about Cabot cheeses, our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, the email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'd like to imagine that your jobs entail you just sitting around eating cheese all day, because that's what I would do if I worked for Agrimark and Cabot Creamery. But first, you, Gina, explain what a cheese grater does.
Absolutely. So I spend my days traveling around the state. We age our cheese in various facilities all around. So before the pandemic, I would grade with Cabot's two other graders, and we would look at cheese together, and we pull our own samples of cheese. So that involves a tool. It's called a trier, and it's pretty cold in these aging facilities. So I, you know, put on lots of warm layers, and I get in there and I pull cheese, and we are tasting it. We're touching it. We're looking at the body of the cheese and trying to make decisions as far as, should this be a deli slicing roll? Are we going to age this? Are we going to cut it now? Is this a premium product? You know, what direction do we take the cheese? And every single vat of cheese that we make, a grater evaluates that vat. And so that's a lot of cheese that I taste in a day, but we do not eat all of the cheese. If you can imagine, that would be a little bit intense. So we don't eat all the cheese, but we do taste it all and do some other evaluations on the product, too.
And there'd be none for the rest of us. So, Gina, if I may, so you take this cheese. It's not necessarily already designated as this will be a this or this will wind up being that. But once you see how it's turning out, then you grade it and decide how to use that cheese. Is that correct?
That's right. Every cheese is very different. And, you know, of course, we make cheese in the Chateauguay, New York plant, as well as Middlebury, Vermont, and Cabot, Vermont. So the cheesemakers and the people and methods in those facilities are all a little bit different. And cheese is just such a unique food. It is so variable. And so when we taste it, we could say, all right, well, this seems like an extra sharp. Or based on, you know, the chemistry of this particular cheese and the flavor profile and the body texture, whatever, this is more of a seriously sharp. Or, you know what, this is going to slice better as a mild. We ought to cut it sooner. So it is not predetermined before a grader evaluates that cheese. So it's fun to get to discover, you know, what each cheese is trying to say.
Oh, what a great job. Jason, you're AgriMark's Vice President of Manufacturing. So give us a little bit about what you do, what your job entails.
Yeah, I have the pleasure really of, you know, working at the front end of the process. You know, Gina's working at the back end of our process, evaluating the products that we make every day. But, you know, I get the opportunity to work with our fine craftsmen within each of our plants that really make and package this cheese in bulk quantities. And, of course, we can't do any of this cheese making without our farmer owners, that it all starts back on the farms where our farmer owners produce that high-quality milk that we intake every day. And our, you know, talented workforce crafts that cheese into the product that ultimately Gina grades and ends up in the packages that all of our great customers get to enjoy every day.
Gina, do we have an idea, a general idea of how many different types of cheese products that Cabot makes?
Oh, my gosh. So yeah. We're talking just about cheese products and not yogurt. And I mean, it's interesting.
If you want to throw them all in one, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, I'm so sorry. It's just between the cottage cheese, right, and then the different types of cheddars. Then we've got Colby, Pepper Jack. We're coming out with new cheeses all the time. Keep your eyes open. Some people don't know we have a Munster cheese through McAdam as well, which is amazing.
Right.
So, like dozens.
Yeah. And then, Jason, where are AgriMark and Cabot cheeses now available?
So our cheeses are available all over the country. And, you know, of course, you know, founding markets are, of course, up here in the Northeast, and so we have a really heavy customer base all across the East. But you can find our products throughout the country. You know, clear over to the West Coast, and you know, Washington, Oregon, California. So have a very wide distribution across the country.
When I was still living in Florida, and I could find it in a supermarket there, I thought I had literally died and gone to heaven. that is the honest truth. And Gina, is there a degree that I can attain to become a cheese grader?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I wish I could tell you that that were the case. My background is not in dairy science or, you know, I did not grow up on a farm myself. I'm enjoying learning about the process as I go along, but you have to have a passion for dairy. You know, I love the idea of the co-op and what the co-op stands for, and I kind of learned apprenticeship style as I went along. So I enjoy cheese and learning about food and food science, but I don't think there's anything that can really prepare you for it except for just like a very genuine excitement for cheese. I think a lot of people could learn how to do it.
Oh, that's great. And
hey, I must say, Rick, a very refined palate is a key to that success. You know, I've spent time with Gina and the graders, you know, trying to understand all of these flavor profiles that they recognize every day. And I must say that I would fail at doing Gina's job. So a very refined palate is key.
All right, Gina, keep him out of the grading division. But Jason,
they don't let me in. They
okay, me in. Yeah. But you've got, you know, what kind of production lines are required? You know, and the challenges for producing, packaging, shipping cheese.
Yeah. So our production lines, you know, across the plants, they vary a little bit, as Gina has already alluded to. But, you know, it mainly involves at a very, very high level. You know, we have very large cheese vats where we fill the vats with milk. Those cheese vats then go into a, you know, we form a curd. That curd then is matted or transferred to a table where our craftsmen, our operators there salt and make sure that we achieve the perfect pH that we need for each of those cheeses and salt quantities and moistures. And then we package the cheese in bulk for aging, as Gina kind of alluded to. So we package that cheese in either 40-pound blocks or 640-pound blocks.
Whoa.
And we send that cheese off to our aging warehouses where we age it, you know, up to 5 years and more, where Gina and the graders really evaluate that cheese on a regular basis, vat by vat. So every single vat gets graded and evaluated and chosen for the right, the perfect package that our consumers where they can enjoy that consistency that they're used to from each of those different packages that they'll find on the shelves.
Jason, you know I'm going to have dreams of a 640-pound block of cheese tonight.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Going to Springfield, we've got Carrie on the line. Hi, Carrie. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I'm wondering, I think you've got a new product that I picked up at a local store here in Springfield called Dill Dip. And I brought it to a neighbor's where we had a little get-together, and they all liked it. Is that a new product?
Thanks, Carrie. Dill Dip, is it new, or have we just been missing it?
You know, Gina? I think that's one of our classic flavors. I think that one has been around for a little while. But our dips are funny that way. Some stores, you know, they have a couple of the flavors. A different store might have a couple different flavors. So maybe it's just the first time in your area, and I'm really glad you like it.
Well, he's got me intrigued. So the next time I'm in a supermarket, that's top of the list. I know I would absolutely love that. All right, let's talk about some awards. Jason, tell us what the National Milk Producers Annual Cheese Contest is all about.
Yeah, so, you know, cheesemakers from across the country have the opportunity to submit entries into this the National Milk Producers Federation's annual cheese contest. And those, you know, submissions get evaluated and graded by people like Gina from across the country. And then they ultimately select all the award winners from you know, hundreds of entries and from manufacturers from across the country. And you know, we were, you know, you'll probably get to this, Rick, but you know, we were you know, just blessed this year, and really shows the dedication, commitment of our farmers and our employees, and you know, a testament to their hard work, where we won the top award along with 15 other awards, but we won the chairman's award for our the Cabot Extra Sharp Vermont cheddar product. So we were just delighted to receive those awards.
Yeah, congratulations on the extra sharp cheddar. And Gina, how do you differentiate between extra sharp and seriously sharp, which was formerly known as Hunter's mm-hmm. cheddar, and that's code to Vermonters for real Vermonters love that one. But how do you, that extra sharp, seriously sharp, how do you determine the mm-hmm. difference between the two?
Yeah, so the seriously sharp, formerly known as the Hunter's cheddar, has some funkier, more wild, unique cheddar flavor. So there's, you know, the acid flavor that you get in cheddar cheese, but there's also sweet notes, maybe cooked notes. You might get some kind of sulfur, fermented, just out of the ordinary flavors for a cheddar, whereas the extra sharp is a more traditional, you know, acidic, balanced cheddar cheese that is not necessarily as variable when it comes to the flavor level, but it's a clean, sharp cheddar. So they're definitely very different.
Mm-hmm. And they're both definitely very delicious. Jason, what were some of the other big winners at that contest?
Yeah, so we, you know, we had, again, we swept the category for sharp cheddar cheeses. So, you know, there's extra sharp, there's medium, there's mild cheddars. So we swept the sharp category and with the first, second, and third place awards, we won a third place award for our medium cheddar. We won a second and third place award for our mild cheddars. And we also, you know, not only took the top award for that chairman's award for our best cheddar, but we also won the second and third place awards in that extra sharp category also. So, you know, as you can see from that, it's, you know, we really had a great showing and are just so proud of our employees and the dedication and efforts that they put into making these products. And, you know, a couple others that are worth definitely worth mentioning, because it doesn't stop with those, is, you know, our, for the unique or mild flavor category, we won a first place. And then for our natural cheese snack categories, we won first, second, and third place for some of our cracker cut cheeses. So for those individuals that don't like to slice their own cheese and stuff and want convenience, you know, we do provide packages with pre-sliced, convenient ways to eat our great cheddar cheese.
Yeah, that is genius. I love picking up those. And Jason, I also like that it's noted that in the different cheeses, Team Middlebury or Team Cabot or Team Chateauguay, next to the honored cheeses. So do the various facilities like to brag about, you know, hey, that one's from us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I'd love to say that, you know, we don't compete, internally, but, you know, we as human beings love to compete. So we, for sure, the employees take a lot of pride in the work that they do every day. And so they love to see that, hey, that product was made at my facility and I had a part in achieving those awards. And they take a lot of pride in, of course, being able to brag about those awards that they achieve from their sites.
Well, talking about pride, Gina, I did a live remote at Harry's Hardware in Cabot last month, and I got this great sense of pride from the folks there, from the people of Cabot, that they're so proud that that you're headquartered there. And I get that same sense of pride from Cabot Cooperative member Dairy Farms, the families. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, man, they should be proud. Everybody at Cabot, Middlebury, Chateauguay work incredibly hard. And the contest, the success of this particular contest is just a testament to how hard everybody works. This year especially, this past year was hard for everybody, but you know, we just kept chugging along and we kept trying to, you know, put food on the shelves. And it took a lot of like creativity, collaboration, people pitching in, volunteering to help out in ways that maybe they didn't think, you know, people had to learn how to help out in cotton wrap. Cotton wrap busted their bums this year working so hard to try to get cheese out for people. And they absolutely should be proud. I know I am. I'm a newbie at the co-op. I've only been working with Cabot for about 5 years, but Cabot is a co-op filled with people who have spent their entire life, you know, spending time and their passion on cheese. And so, yeah, the roots definitely run deep with that, I would say.
Yeah. And Gina, Agrimark also brought home three international cheese and dairy awards in November. Tell us a little bit about those.
Sure. So what's fun about the contest is we enter, you know, 10, sometimes 12, you know, it varies a little bit year to year, but we enter large and small ones. So we enter, you know, both local small ones as well as the international ones. And the international ones are just absolutely crazy. It's cheese from all over the world. And then here's us, right? Little Cabot, Vermont, you know, pumping out a little bit of cheese here relative to some of these bigger producers. And to have recognition on that scale is absolutely crazy. But I'll say we also take a lot of pride in, you know, some of the smaller contests, like, for example, the Big E in Springfield, Massachusetts. Yeah. We've entered cheese in that for a long time now, and it's awesome for our friends and neighbors to get to enjoy our cheese.
Well, I don't want to slight yogurt. And, Jason, I just want to tell you, that triple cream yogurt, if you ever stop making that, you will find me on the picket line outside all three of these plants protesting. That is gold, my friend.
Is it not? Is it not? Right? It's one of my weaknesses, Rick, is, ice creams and that creamy yogurt that you have there is right up there with ice cream for me. And as you probably noted there in that international contest, right, our chocolate mousse triple cream yogurt was the highest scoring yogurt from the United States.
Yeah.
So we take a lot of pride, and that's a new product for us. And so for those that are listening and haven't had an opportunity to enjoy that, please check out our triple cream yogurt that you'll find at some of your retailers in your area, because it's a really fabulous product, as you state.
Yeah, I hope our friend Carrie in Springfield, our caller earlier, finds that. Jason, very quickly, you got about 45 seconds, but when you do have a new Cabot product, what does that mean for you and your department?
Yeah, so, you know, we spend, it's a very long process for us to evaluate and explore new products. And it starts really with our R&D group and really understanding what is it that fits within our Cabot brand profile. And they'll come up with ideas. We explore, we test, we pilot, we taste with many of our internal employees and such. And we go through an iterative process until we perfect something that we think is worthy of putting in that Cabot brand package. And then we prepare our manufacturing processes to be able to launch that on a scale where we can satisfy our customers as they enjoy those new products. So it's a very iterative process and it's a lot of fun to experiment, for us and launch those new products.
Your employees have great taste. Jason Martin is Agrimark's Vice President of Manufacturing. Gina Corsi is Cabot Creamery's Cheese Grater. I want to congratulate you on the bushel basket of awards that your cheeses have won. And thank you so much for creating these wonderful cheeses and for being on this show.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, again, take care. Thanks for having us.
Sure thing. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday when we hear about old forests, an old pirate camp, and the new plans for an old college campus in Pulteney.